From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
If you think unaffordable housing is just in the buyer's market, you obviously haven't checked the prices of rental properties recently.
Households that might have otherwise become homeowners are staying in the rental market.
Also this week, we'll discover that manufactured home rentals are just as, if not more, unaffordable as conventional housing.
If you're on Social Security or you have a modest income, that prices you out of the market.
We'll also do some tax-free back-to-school shopping, and we'll meet a guy who has been forming a new initiative to improve mental health among a group of folks who've long been overlooked. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. The median cost of housing for Florida renters rose by almost $500 per month between 2019 and 2023. That's according to a new report from the University of Florida. Tristan Wood reports that puts housing outside what's typically considered affordable for many Florida families.
More than 900,000 low-income households in Florida are now paying nearly 40% of their paycheck to cover rent and housing costs such as utilities. That's more than the 30% that's typically considered affordable. Ann Ray is a researcher at the University of Florida's Scheinberg Center for Housing Studies. She says those rising costs come as over a million new people have moved to Florida.
There's been in-migration from the Northeast, from California, from Illinois. There's also been some people moving from some of the higher cost areas of Florida to places that up until recently were relatively affordable.
High costs in Miami-Dade, Orange, and Broward counties have sent Floridians to other counties. Ray says the areas seeing the most migration are Central Florida counties, connected to large metro areas like Tampa and Orlando.
Lee County, Pasco County, Polk County are some of the fastest growing counties, not just in the state, but in the country.
That growing population has led to spiking rents as housing demand has increased. Ray says another factor driving up rental costs is the high price to purchase a home.
Because home prices are very high, households that might have otherwise become homeowners are staying in the rental market. So that places additional pressure on the rental market.
The study is conducted every 3 years to serve as a resource for the Florida Housing Finance Corporation. Created by the Florida legislature, the corporation works to incentivize the construction of affordable housing for low-income families through tax credits for developers and other programs. Ray says her study is used to highlight the areas of most need in Florida.
These are programs that are designed to produce and preserve affordable housing for lower income renters, for workers in service jobs, seniors, and people with disabilities.
You can find a link to the full report on our website at WFSU.org. I'm Tristan Wood.
A lot of mobile home owners in Florida are being priced out of their communities since World War II. It's been one of the easiest paths to home ownership. Buy a manufactured building and rent the lot underneath. That especially works well for retired folks on fixed incomes, but that has changed as lot rents steadily climb. WUSF's Gabriella Paul brings us the story with some reporting from Octavio Jones.
A lot of people buy manufactured homes for the same reasons. It's a way to live affordably, with neighbors your age and a park that maintains public spaces like landscaping and a community clubhouse. Owners in parks across the Tampa Bay region say it felt like it would last forever.
I bought my home in December of 2012. I liked the way it looked at that time. It looked tropical, quiet, serene, and it was 55 and older.
That's Dara Brown. She cleaned out her 401k to buy a home in Riverview. Daniel Clearwater says he bought a place in Pinellas County to build some equity. It was his retirement plan.
We started thinking, why do we want to live in a condo when we could live in a mobile home and then own our own home instead of paying somebody else rent?
Judy Schofield traveled from Connecticut to enjoy her golden years at Royal Palm Village in Haines City.
I decided I'd come down here because my daughter lived in Claremont. And we found this home, and I love this home. What's bothering me now is the fact that I'm probably going to have to leave.
That's because she doesn't own the land her home sits on. Dara, Daniel, and Judy bought their homes for a fraction of what a single-family home costs. And they rented a lot underneath their homes for roughly $400 a month. But in the last decade, Daniel says his lot rent doubled.
It was like $450, and that was back in 2010. Well, now here we are, and we are actually paying, I just paid the bill, $840 for the lot rent.
This is part of a larger trend in Florida, where census data show median lot rents have doubled since 2015. In the Tampa metro, research shows lot rents at manufactured home parks are growing faster in the last decade than rents for single-family homes. Jeff Grable is a lawyer with Bay Area Legal Services. He helps residents deal with landlord disputes. He says the jump in lot rents are pricing people out of the homes they own.
$100, $200 extra per month might be doable for someone who's working, making a decent living. But if you're on Social Security or you have a modest income, that prices you out of the market.
That's been the case for Dara in Riverview since her lot rent shot up to nearly $1,000 a month.
It takes my whole Social Security just to pay my lot fee.
Over in Polk County, Judy says she'd be okay with rent hikes if it meant better services around the park. In Clearwater, Daniel agrees. He says the lack of management is putting him at wit's end.
We are just so tired of the lip service here and not getting any actual service.
Grable says some homeowners are suing park management over situations similar to Daniel's. There's a federal case brewing right now against dozens of parks across the country, and several of them are in Florida.
If you read this class action lawsuit, they're talking about increased rents and decrease in services.
Grable says manufactured homeowners have some other options to push back on parks, but it often requires legal expertise and organizing with other neighbors. He says by the time he meets homeowners dealing with lot rent issues, it's already too late.
You're either forced to try to come up with the money, try to sell your mobile home, or face eviction.
Moving the house is rarely an option. Forbes estimates it can cost up to $18,000 to move a manufactured home. That's why Dara in Riverview tried to sell.
There's nothing else I can do but to sell it and find somewhere where I don't know.
She fell behind on rent and was evicted before she could find a buyer. Judy says for now she's paying bills with help from her daughter. And she went back to work as a cashier. Judy is 86.
I probably won't be able to stay. And I'm looking at places that I can move to, which is very emotional because I really don't want to leave my home. But I don't think I'm going to have much of a choice.
Daniel says rising lot rent is making it harder for him to sell, too.
We just want to get out of here. And people come up now, they go, hey, how much you want for the place? And I tell them, well, we'd like to see $40,000. And they're like, how much is a lot rent? $800? Well, I can't afford that.
Daniel, Dara, and Judy say they're nearly out of options. And there's no easy way out of their forever homes. I'm Gabriella Paul in Tampa.
Governor Ron DeSantis is expressing concerns about artificial intelligence and says he'll be rolling out an approach on the issue within the next few months. Speaking to Florida sheriffs this week, DeSantis did not provide details about what he'll seek to do, but he pointed to what he calls significant questions about the fast-expanding technology. DeSantis says he does not know whether his approach will require legislation, but he feels the state needs to develop its own approach on the evolving issue.
We can't put our head in the sand and just say we're not going to deal with AI at all because it is becoming a fact of life. But, you know, we can't just turn the reins over to a bunch of tech overlords. That doesn't work.
DeSantis says that Florida won't be able to police every aspect of AI, but the state needs the ability to provide protection for people. Coming up on Capitol Report, Governor DeSantis wants Florida to redo its political districts with an exclusion for those without legal status.
I don't believe illegal aliens should be counted in the census. I think it's wrong. I think it's unconstitutional.
Florida's month-long back-to-school sales tax holiday is underway. We'll discuss its impact on customers, businesses, and government.
Generally, our retailers report they absolutely see an uptick, and it doesn't come at the expense of other sales.
Across North Florida, one man's mission is helping black men break the silence and the stigma around mental health through real access, connection, and care.
Black men are not necessarily transparent about what's going on. They tend to believe that they're the only ones going through an issue.
Florida has seen a string of heat advisories in recent days, with heat indexes topping 110 in some areas. Concern about the heat has some people looking to Florida prisons, where the majority of inmates don't have access to air conditioning. Margie Menzel reports this comes after Governor Ron DeSantis earlier this summer vetoed funding for a pilot program that would have provided air conditioning for some prisons.
The governor's veto decision was disappointing for advocates who had hoped better prison conditions could lead to a better chance for rehabilitation.
I think that incarcerated people expected it. They expect so little from our government.
Denise Rock is the executive director of the nonprofit Florida Cares Charity Corporation.
But I do think that the families and the loved ones of people that are incarcerated on the outside were hugely disappointed. This is sad for them to see that their loved ones continue to suffer and languish in hot prisons in Florida.
But Barney Bishop, CEO of the Florida Smart Justice Alliance, says he's not worried about the comfort of incarcerated people.
You know what? If you're worried about whether you have air conditioning in a prison, don't commit a crime.
Bishop says the Florida Smart Justice Alliance supports the Florida Sheriff's Association and the prosecuting attorneys. He says air conditioning state prisons is a difficult and expensive undertaking, given the age of many of the facilities.
And there's no mood in the Florida legislature to build new prisons.
Former State Senator Jeff Brandis, who now heads the Florida Policy Project, agrees that state leaders aren't interested in improving prisons. But he says it's a dangerous choice, especially in this heat.
What the wardens will tell you, and even the Department of Corrections will tell you, is violence goes up during the summer. It's not just the heat, it's the violence that goes along with the heat, because people are more irritated, they're agitated, and they're set off easier. And that means more trips to the emergency rooms.
Brandis is also concerned about the number of elderly people in Florida prisons. And he's calling for the governor and state leaders to come experience the conditions for themselves.
This is the perfect week for legislators to get out there, perfect week for them to see what people feel like in the prisons. But let me tell you, when you walk into those dorms, and it's hotter on the inside than it is outside, and it's 100 degrees outside, you really have to wonder what we're doing.
Brandis points out that in the Dade Correctional Institution, which houses more than 1,500 men, at least four have died from heat-related causes in the last 4 years in that one facility alone. I'm Margie Menzel.
Governor Ron DeSantis says Florida's congressional maps could be changed again. He's not happy with the outcome of the 2020 census. And WUSF's Douglas Soule reports his comments come as Republican-controlled states are trying to increase GOP representation in the U.S. House.
Florida didn't set aside any money for outreach during the 2020 census count. Some groups, like Florida Tax Watch, had warned about a population undercount, leading to fewer U.S. House seats and fewer federal dollars. And that's what happened. Governor Ron DeSantis now takes issue with how the state only has 28 House representatives, just one more than last decade.
We got a raw deal on the census. We only got one seat. When some of these other states were getting seats, when we've obviously had more growth, we should have gotten at least two.
A recent report from Florida Tax Watch says the governor is right. The group's VP and attorney, Jeff Kottkamp, says there was a big difference.
We undercounted by 750,000 people, and that's a conservative estimate. And other states counted every single person they could find.
The report says part of the reason is the immigrant community is hesitant to participate in the census. Renata Bozzetto from the Florida Immigrant Coalition says there's not only hesitancy, but also fear.
First, we need trust. Trust in all layers of the system.
But she says it's important people in the country without proper documents are counted.
That is just completely unacceptable. He knows that this is costing Floridians.
Yet DeSantis defends the lack of outreach funding.
I think a lot of that money would have been wasted, quite frankly. And some of that, the blue states are doing that to count illegal aliens. I don't believe illegal aliens should be counted in the census. I think it's wrong. I think it's unconstitutional. How many seats would California lose if you only counted lawful people, lawful citizens?
The Constitution says every person should be counted, not every citizen. Kottkamp says Florida should not ignore it.
All I know is, you know, Article 1, Section 2 of the United States Constitution says count every person, and that's what we need to do. We need to make sure whatever the rules are going to be, whether we count these people or don't count these people, that everybody counts the same so we have a level playing field.
The census is done at the start of every decade. But DeSantis not only wants to change who is counted, he wants a mid-decade count. Dan Vicuña of the voting rights group Common Cause says it wouldn't make sense to do another census.
It would be incredibly expensive, especially in a state as large as Florida. You have to hire thousands of census workers to redo something 5 years after we already have census data.
Common Cause's state group challenged Florida's current congressional map. They and others say the state unlawfully removed a majority black district to increase Republican representation. The state Supreme Court recently ruled the map can stay in place. But DeSantis says, regardless of the census, he's exploring a new map to redraw congressional lines.
This is obviously something that we're looking at very seriously. I've said that I would look favorably on the legislature taking it up. So I would just say stay tuned on that.
At President Donald Trump's urging, Texas is considering a congressional map that would add 5 GOP seats. Now, Republican and Democratic states alike are exploring similar avenues in a political war for the House majority. Redistricting expert and University of Florida professor Daniel Smith thinks it would be hard to add more Republicans to Florida's delegation. The map already favors them.
That is going to be almost impossible to do because right now Florida has almost no competitive seats.
He says maybe the state can find a way in South Florida, but that could affect everything else.
Anytime you redraw a line, you're going to affect the rest of the map by shifting these districts because they all have to still have the same population.
DeSantis says he sees potential problems in South Florida, where there are multiple Democratic representatives. A new map requires a special session and lawmaker approval. Legislative leadership is not talking. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
Today, Friday, August 1st, is a particularly happy day for Florida's back-to-school shoppers. Governor Ron DeSantis says the reason is apparent at the checkout register.
Starting August 1st and going all the way till the end of August this year, Floridians can save money on important school supplies. So school supplies that are tax-free, most school supplies under $50, tax-free. Clothing, footwear, and other apparel, $100 or less, tax-free. Learning aids for $30 or less, tax-free. Personal computers and certain accessories, $1,500 or less, when purchased for non-commercial use, entirely tax-free.
And the governor says it's not just because the tax-free period is longer this year.
What's different now is the back-to-school sales tax holiday is in law, doesn't expire. It will be every August.
So the back-to-school sales tax holiday is both longer and more predictable than ever. Among those most eager that the word has gotten out to consumers is Bill Hurley. He's the executive director of the National Federation of Independent Business, Florida.
The big boxes and the big guys, they'll make sure their customers hear about this. But everyone needs to be reminded that this will apply to every shop you walk into, including your community, neighborhood, small businesses.
Hurley calls the sales tax holiday a big boon for both businesses and customers.
Generally, our retailers report that they absolutely see an uptick, and it doesn't come at the expense of other sales. Sales are consistent in the run-up to it and coming out of it, so it does seem to motivate shoppers. And what's fun about the sales tax holiday, it's sort of the Build-A-Bear of tax cuts. How much you save is how much you want to go out and go buy new things for your kids for the school year. So they can go out there and save as much as they want to.
Not everyone agrees with the Build-A-Bear simile, though. One such organization is the Washington, D.C.-based Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. It advocates a more level playing field when it comes to taxes. The Institute's Miles Trinidad has issued a white paper that concludes Florida's tax situation is about as unlevel a playing field as you can get.
They found that Florida is the number one most regressive tax system in the country. So somebody who's in the top 1% pays only about 2.7% of their income towards taxes. And then the lowest 20% pay about 13.2% of their income towards taxes.
Trinidad says Florida is one of 18 states that have adopted tax-free holidays of one kind or another, but he insists they all share the same flaw.
On the surface, this sounds great, sounds reasonable, but these sales tax-free shopping sprees for, you know, select items, there's nothing to reduce taxes for low and moderate income taxpayers for all the other days of the year. And conversely, like multi-year taxpayers are often better positioned to benefit from these temporary exemptions from taxes because they can have greater flexibility to shift the timing of their purchases to take advantage of this tax break.
The NFIB's Bill Hurley disagrees.
You could not find a more appropriately targeted tax cut to approach than the sales tax in giving Floridians of all income levels some relief on that. I would push back that for lower income Floridians, the sales tax holiday is of even greater importance.
Hurley also cites data showing sales tax holidays actually wind up boosting the overall tax revenue.
In the past, we have seen bumps in sales tax revenue collections year over year that can be attributed to just the increased foot traffic and consumers benefiting by sales tax-free items and then treating themselves to something they otherwise might not have bought that is taxable.
Again, Trinidad has a different take.
Even though there might be like a temporary boost within the window of the sales tax holiday, it just merely shifts the timing of these purchases. So someone who may have purchased it, you know, maybe a week before the holiday may wait a week to make that purchase during the sales tax holiday. And then this also brings us back to the point where, you know, people who make more money, who are wealthier, are able to take advantage of their flexibility to make those purchases during the holiday compared to those who live paycheck to paycheck who may not be able to wait.
Of course, all this back and forth only brushes against the larger debate, a heavy reliance on sales tax revenue in Florida. And Trinidad insists that's the real issue.
Actually, the sales tax holiday is kind of just like a cover for a state that has the most unfair tax system in the country because Florida has to rely so heavily on sales and excise taxes to raise revenue. So overall, in the other 11 months of the year, low-income families end up paying a far greater share of their incomes in the state than the wealthy toward taxes.
Meanwhile, it seems likely that come the 2026 session, lawmakers may again take up the matter of cutting more taxes, whether sales taxes or property taxes. State wildlife officials this month could approve rules for a three-week bear hunt in December that would have a far more structured format than a hunt that was held a decade ago. The proposed rules, which will be considered by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission during a meeting set for mid-August, would include a lottery-style permitting process and up to 187 bears being killed in four areas of the state. The rules also would include guidelines to encourage hunters to kill male bears. George Warthen, the commission's chief conservation officer, says the proposed hunt is an additional method to manage bears as they coexist with humans.
We're one of the only states that is not participating in regulated bear hunting in states that have abundant bear populations. And so it's another tool for wildlife managers to be able to slowly start to manage population growth.
Bear hunting has long been a controversial issue in Florida, with opponents saying that killing bears for sport won't reduce human-bear interactions. They also say the commission should expand the use of non-lethal options, such as bear-proof trash containers, to help keep bears from being drawn to residences and businesses and should increase land conservation efforts. But calls to hold a hunt have been growing. The 2015 hunt ended after 2 days when 305 bears were killed in what was expected to be a week-long endeavor. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, suicide is the third leading cause of death for black males between the ages of 10 and 24, and they're four times more likely to die by suicide than black females. In a world where silence can be deadly, a new initiative is working to close that gap by expanding mental health outreach and representation across Florida's Big Bend. Jasmine Sutherland reports.
John Brown's Black Men's Mental Health Initiative connects Black men to mental health care.
There will always be, you know, work to be done. There will always be, an overwhelming need.
He says the program will increase awareness, improve access, and boost outcomes through both group and one-on-one sessions. Brown's program recently received a $24,000 grant from the United Way of the Big Bend. The funding will support operations in 5 counties across the region, including Madison, Jefferson, and Gadsden County. Although some of these counties are predominantly white, community leaders see the importance of having mental health services for Black men.
You can look at almost any statistical data, and unfortunately for Black men, a lot of times we're the first and the worst.
Brown is also partnering with Tallahassee's National Alliance on Mental Illness, also known as NAMI. The organization provides education and support for people living with mental illness and their families. Nancy O'Farrell, NAMI's executive director, says she's worked alongside Brown for more than a decade. Together, they've been deeply involved in mental health advocacy across the region.
Everything we do in NAMI is offered at no charge. So, working with John and kind of following his vision of what this initiative is going to look like, his volunteer workforce to the extent that he can use the skill sets that we have and the training that we have from National NAMI.
Brown's initiative is already doing the work to bring Black men together. For example, every month, Joey Womack gathers online with a circle of Black men from across the South for honest conversations, often centered around mental health.
Black men are not necessarily transparent about what's going on. They tend to believe that they're the only one going through an issue. And keeping that type of stressors in typically only ends up in something that's bad. I think the stress is going to come out of you one way. You know, you're going to talk about it, it's going to force its way out.
Womack recently invited John Brown to one of his roundtable discussions.
Having that discussion was extremely powerful. It led to a number of members opening up and discussing topics, you know, related to their health they never would have shared before. People were sharing resources, best practices, and things like that.
Brown says the idea for his initiative came as he looked back on the media landscape of the late 90s and early 2000s. When he picked up health magazines, the covers usually featured white men or wealthy, high-profile Black men. For example,
Barack Obama, you know, wonderful timing, amazing individual, definitely background experience, but how many more Barack Obamas are there going to be, right? So as it relates to health, if we can only see ourselves in the 2 to 3 percentile related to health, that's problematic.
And while those figures are inspirational, Brown says they don't reflect the everyday realities most Black men face. Brown hopes his initiative will challenge the belief that mental health and wellness are reserved for the wealthy or highly successful, and emphasize that every Black man deserves access to care and to know they are not alone.
If somebody is in some kind of crisis, some kind of situation in the moment, they feel like they've lost all hope, that they can, you know, reach out to somebody, at a minimum, get to tomorrow. And getting to tomorrow could look like, I'm not on an island, I'm not by myself.
Brown's program shows healing is possible when Black men are heard, seen, and supported. I'm Jasmine Sutherland.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Gabriella Paul, Octavio Jones, Douglas Saul, and Jasmine Sutherland. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.